Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of the Mem Podcast. I'm Demi Wright, and if you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Instagram at mem.cast for our weekly question of the week. This week, we have returning again is our superstar TNO registrar, Dr. Rohisha. Hi, Rohi.
Hi, Demi. Thank you for having me again.
Thanks for joining us again. So this week, we're going to be talking about a important topic, so Cauda Equina Syndrome versus cord compression. So this one is more important from a clinical point of view and just being able to identify and work up appropriately. So just identifying the red flag symptoms and managing appropriately. So let's start. Can you just tell me what is Cauda Equina Syndrome and how does it differ from cord compression?
Sure. So cord equina syndrome is a clinical diagnosis resulting from dysfunction of one or more of the lumbosacral nerve roots. Now, typically, it's associated with a large space-occupying lesion, which, you know, in the canal of the lumbosacral spine, and that can usually be a disc. But you have other things, such as an infective mass, cancer, or primary or metastatic lesion. Any space-occupying lesion in the cauda equina causing compression will result in cauda equina syndrome. The two main points for a cauda equina syndrome, you need a clinical history, obviously with your examination, and you can have a MRI or a CT scan to confirm the diagnosis.
Right.
You asked how it differs from cord compression. Perhaps the better way to understand it is just the anatomy of the cords. We all know the spinal cord is a continuation from the brainstem, and it extends from the base of the skull to the L1, L2, after which it terminates into the cornus medullaris, at the cauda equina after that, which is a group of nerves from the end of the spinal cord.
Yeah.
Now, if a space-occupying lesion compresses those group of nerves, the cauda equina, you get cauda equina syndrome.
Yeah.
If a space-occupying lesion compresses the cord higher than that, so anything proximal from the brainstem all the way down to the termination, then you get cord compression syndromes.
Okay.
And that's sort of the basis of the two.
Okay. And why is it, or is it important to distinguish between the two?
It is important because sometimes patients present with cauda equina type symptoms may actually have a higher or much more proximal lesion, which is actually the reason why our new sort of spinal protocols say anyone presenting with cauda equina type symptoms should have a whole spine MRI rather than a segmental scan, because you will miss a more proximal lesion causing compression, resulting in more distal symptoms as well.
Right. Okay. So you did mention quite a few of the common causes. So you said space-occupying lesion,
yeah,
infection. Are those the most common causes of these?
Usually, yeah. I think the lumbar disc is one of the commonest causes of, or a disc herniation is one of the commonest causes of a cauda equina syndrome. But as you mentioned, yes, so, you know, cancer, metastatic lesions, or primary lesions can cause it. Trauma can cause it as well, which is quite important in the context of an elderly patient. But with trauma, just to clarify, you have an unstable fracture fragment,
yeah,
which again pushes into the cord,
right,
and that can cause either cord compression, or if it's an unstable lumbosacral fragment, can cause cauda equina compression, resulting in a similar picture.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I think that's probably, from a medical point of view, the setting that we're most likely going to see these patients,
sure,
is, you know, we do get a lot of elderly patients that come in with falls, and then they come in. They might say, oh, I had a fall and now I'm having some weakness, or I'm having some back pain. So because we do have these patients that come in with a fall, I think it's important for people to know, okay, they've had a fall. Are there any red flags? Do I need to investigate this? And what's the timeline that I need, yeah, to be looking into this? So shall we just flesh out the clinical features a,
yeah,
bit more of each of them? So what are the key red flag symptoms that we should always ask for if we're suspecting that there could be cauda compression or cauda equina?
Okay. So I think you mentioned a few already in terms of the symptoms you need to look out for. And as I mentioned earlier, it's actually a clinical diagnosis, and it's supplemented by an MRI scan to confirm your diagnosis.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of a retrospective review done by one of the authors, and they actually found that radiculopathy was present in about 90% of the patients. So that's quite a high number. And that's where you get your bilateral leg pain, and you have back pain as well, which accounts for about 83%. Then you have the slightly less common ones, but more important ones. So you have urinary retention, which is in about 60% of the patients, and you have urinary incontinence, which is usually overflow incontinence from about 55% of the patients. So these are all your subjective markers, and that's what the patient will tell you. What objectively, when you're examining a patient, they'll have reduced perineal sensation in about 75% of the patients. They'll have some sensory deficit in the legs, or an absent ankle jerk reflex, weakness, or a absent anal tone in about half the patients.
Right. Okay. Shall we talk about the perineal sensation?
Sure. Yeah.
And the anal tone. So, I mean, you know, as a medical junior, I've frequently had consultants, you know, say do a rectal exam to check for these. I was always like, well, I never really felt anyone who's never had it. So I'm like, well, I guess it feels all right. I mean, is there anything that you can suggest that would be helpful?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's I think it's an important thing to document. Just, you know, anytime you diagnose someone, it's an important thing to document. Because if your symptoms progress, so someone once told me that, again, with anal tone, it's either present or it's absent. There is no in between. You know, if a patient with a true caudal equina syndrome has an absent anal tone, they will, you know, if you ask them to squeeze or cough, there will be absolutely nothing there.
Okay.
There is no gray area in that.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to document in the first instance, because if examined, you know, a week later and you have progression from, you know, again, a week is a bit excessive, but you have progression from a present anal tone to an absent one, that means there's progression of symptoms that requires something doing.
Yeah.
And I think just to put that together, because more important than anal tone, we actually look at the bladder dysfunction.
Right.
And specifically what we're looking for is the post-void bladder scan.
Okay.
And thankfully we now have an objective marker as well. And our cutoff is actually 200 mils from a Nottingham study, in fact, that showed, and they looked at about 260 patients, and they said that actually it has quite a high positive predictive value, again, of about 94%. So if you have a bladder scan of more than 200 mils post-void, I think it's important refer it on to orthopedic so we can make a decision whether we're going to decompress or not.
Fine. Okay. Yeah. So I think that's a really good point. Well, you made several good points there. So anal tone, present or not, so yeah. Not slightly reduced or slightly increased.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's a really good point. And then the perianal sensation, that's just totally lost, present or lost, I imagine.
So perianal sensation is a bit different. So you can have it reduced because, again, we have a grading of 0, 1, 2.
Okay.
And again, 2 is normal, 1 is reduced, and 0 is completely absent. But I think it's just the anal tone that's either present or absent.
Fine.
It might be easy at this point just to mention, fill out an ASIA chart, because that gives you all the information that's there.
ASIA chart.
If you Google it.
I think I do vaguely remember that, actually.
So most spinal departments will use an ASIA chart. So every day there'll be someone filling out an ASIA chart. And again, what you can tell from that is just is progression in neurology or improvement in cases where things are, you know, things are improving.
Okay.
But it gives you a baseline measure, and it's a fairly straightforward chart to fill out.
Okay.
And file it in the patient's notes.
Okay. So in terms of the post-void bladder scan, I think that's actually really helpful, because we do get particularly elderly patients that they might come in with a fall and then they've now complained of new urinary incontinence. So I think that's another thing to just keep in mind or bear in mind, that if we do have that sort of red flag symptom, to look into, could it be, you know, something sinister, in the sense that something that we need to investigate urgently. So you did mention the MRI scan, you mentioned the whole MRI scan, and you said urgent, but what is the actual timing of the scan that we should be doing?
Okay. In my opinion, any patient who's presented with the red flag symptoms we described and has a positive post-void bladder scan of above 200, there is a strong argument to get an urgent MRI scan as soon as possible. I wouldn't delay that for the next day. Now, the reason I mention that is we have our own classification of caudal equina syndrome. There's about 5 different types that we classify them.
Yeah.
And we are trying to target something called caudal equina syndrome early, where patients have some perineal sensory changes or micturition symptoms, but generally bowel and sexual function are preserved. And the second is caudal equina syndrome incomplete, where you have altered bladder function sensation without perineal sensory loss or bladder dysfunction. These are the two groups that you can actually target early, and they say early surgery for these two groups is equivalent to a better outcome.
Okay.
So if you've got patients, you pick them up early, they've got all the right red flag symptoms, get an urgent scan, because because the chances are likely, the general consensus is we will decompress them at the next available slot. It's not something that we'd wait overnight for. Now, if you have a patient that's got established retention, then you're looking at potentially, you're still working an urgent MRI scan from a medical point of view, but from a surgical point of view, you could probably delay decompression to the next morning rather than doing it overnight. And again, there are several factors from our point of view, including theatre staff and having the right, you know, the right staff available rather than doing it overnight or waiting 3 hours. But again, what we're trying to do is with the early scan is identify the cord that we can intervene that we know will have a good outcome rather than patients with established symptoms.
Right.
So,
okay.
So get a scan early.
Right. So from a medical point of view,
regardless,
we need to organize that scan urgently. And then you guys are going to determine the timing of the surgery.
Yeah.
So anybody that we're worried about cardioquina or cord compression, they need an MRI as we consider that as a potential diagnosis.
Absolutely.
So if that's overnight, we need to call in the radiographers to come and do that overnight.
And I think now it's an accepted consensus that you will get an urgent scan overnight. And again, and that's where the pulse-width bladder scan is quite helpful because that's your objective marker to get an urgent scan. And it's an accepted protocol all over the UK.
Right. Okay. So I guess that's going to be tied in with, in terms of referral to ortho, I think you would need that MRI before referring to you guys.
Because that's the first thing we'll say, get an MRI.
So you're like, why are you calling me at midnight without an MRI? So don't be afraid to call them, but just get the MRI first. Okay, fine. And so you mentioned that you would be doing urgent surgery. Briefly, can you just talk us through about, you know, how you do manage them?
Yeah. So essentially what we're trying to do is do a deep compression, and it doesn't take particularly long, it takes about an hour to do, but there's a lot of patient positioning and faff around that. And what we're trying to do is remove the disc that's actually there and then free up the cord and prevent and basically remove the site of compression of the cord equine or the cord itself.
Okay.
In instances where it's a fracture causing it, then we have to stabilize the spine at the same time by putting some metalwork in.
Okay.
Essentially we're removing the causative factor. You know, if it's a disc, we remove the disc. We might do what we call a laminectomy or just to give a bit of space at the back of the cord as well. So, you know, essentially what we're trying to do is remove the causative factor and free up the cord or the cord equina.
And then you guys don't tend to give steroids?
If we think that there is a metastatic cord compression, then yes, we would give steroids. And it's important, again, to remember that proximal compression can cause cord equina type symptoms. But if it's a pure disc that's causing it, then a steroid's not indicated. It's usually a cancerous lesion. And again, we won't give steroids for an infective mass either. So.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Rohi. That was extremely useful. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And to all our listeners, don't forget to join us on Instagram for our weekly question of the week. And please do get in touch if you have any special requests. We'll see you next time.